Support for IPR and this podcast comes from the IMT Des Moines Marathon, October 19th and 20th, with 6 race events including the full and half marathons, marathon relay, 5K, and more. Register at DesMoinesMarathon.com.
Native American issues were in the spotlight this week in a Sioux City forum that included Democratic presidential candidates. This hour, we'll hear about those concerns. It's a NewsBuzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Also this hour, Democratic presidential hopefuls court organized labor. Border enforcement contracts provide a boon to Iowa business. We'll hear about a man who asked about animal cruelty at the Iowa State Fair and then was ejected for life. And Lost Island Theme Park in Waterloo breaks ground on a $100 million expansion. Buckle up for your NewsBuzz. First, this news from NPR. It's a NewsBuzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Let's start with what happened on Wednesday near Des Moines when more than a dozen Democrats running for president courted organized labor. That was at a meeting of union leaders. Joining us to talk about it, someone who was there, Katarina Sestarek, IPR's state government reporter. Hi, Katarina.
Hi, Ben.
Tell us about this meeting. Who was there? What was going on?
It was the annual meeting of the Iowa Federation of Labor, so it's labor leaders, union leaders from across the state. And this year there were 15 Democrats running for president trying to win the support of union members.
Mm-hmm. And this is interesting, too, because traditionally unions have been primarily for Democratic candidates. But in the last election, Donald Trump did better than previous Republican candidates, didn't he?
Right. So in 2016, nationally, Democrat Hillary Clinton won union households by 8%, but that was the smallest margin in the past 3 decades. And so Democrats have historically counted on union support in presidential elections. And so this meeting near Des Moines in Altoona this week was a chance for Democrats to sort of try to win back some of that support that they've lost and try to turn out more people to vote. People from the labor movement.
Mm-hmm. So tell us, what did organized labor have to say to these 15 candidates and vice versa?
Well, the Iowa president of the Iowa Federation of Labor, Ken Sager, he said there have been these attacks on labor by the far right, is what he said, over the past 2 to 3 decades that have led to the decline of the middle class, widening income inequality. He mentioned the Iowa legislature specifically, how they severely limited collective bargaining rights for public sector workers when Republicans took control of the legislature in 2017 and also reduced workers' comp, especially for shoulder injuries. And this is also something that candidates brought up later in the day, specific to Iowa. But mostly he was saying that elections have consequences, and he just wanted the people in the room to listen to the candidates and think about the consequences of Trump getting elected to another term. He says, of course, that President Trump is bad for unions and for workers. And then the group also heard from the National AFL-CIO President Richard Trumka. He said he doesn't really care if a candidate is a Republican or Democrat, but he just wants a candidate to show that a candidate who will show that they really prioritize unions and workers, and they want to make this election about workers and not just about the personality of the candidate.
Mm-hmm. And while you were there, you also spoke with a union member, didn't you?
Right. So, of course, we heard from Democratic candidates all day railing against the Trump administration and against Republicans, what they were calling an anti-worker, anti-union agenda. But I talked to a man there who said he works in the coal industry, and he voted for Trump, and he had a bit more nuanced view of the situation.
Well, they're shutting down the coal industry, and that affected my family, and I had to move. So with the Obama administration, all the regulations with global warming and all that, you know, we're losing jobs. So, I mean, we vote for a Democrat, we lose jobs. We vote for a Republican, it's against our union, against the unions. So we're in a hard spot. I think there are union members that secretly vote for Trump because they don't want anybody to know. And I think a lot of people are doing that. Trump is, he puts America first. I'm a veteran. You know, I did serve 12 years in the Army, and I just, I feel like we need to put Americans first, you know. I'm open-minded, that's why I'm here, I'm open-minded, but I mean, they've got to sway me, and I just haven't been swayed yet.
Mm, interesting comment that you collected there, Katerina, especially union members secretly voting for Trump. Tell us a little bit more about the Democrats and what their pitches were in this context.
A lot of them started out by just trying to describe their connections to unions, you know, talking about their parents or their grandparents who were part of unions, and talking about, you know, how unions benefited their lives. Some of them had stories about that. And then a lot of them went on to say that there's an attack on unions and workers happening. And they all just sort of tried to talk up their, you know, their previous support for unions. They said, look at my previous record. Some of the people like Vice President Joe Biden, Senator Warren, Senator Sanders, they were all like, we have history of being on the picket lines. We have history of voting for labor. Like, look at my record. And some of the newer candidates saying things like, you know, if we don't bolster unions and therefore the middle class, we're going to lose the American dream. So there was a lot of just pro-union language. Some had more specific policy ideas that day than others, like Senator Bernie Sanders. He announced a new pro-union plan at the event that would even involve, he said, reversing what the Iowa legislature did in 2017 and blocking states from taking steps like that in the future, to blocking states from restricting collective bargaining rights.
Mm-hmm. With this meeting in mind, what would you say is the outlook for 2020? Obviously, the Democrats want to regain some ground that they lost in 2016 to Trump in regards to the unions, right?
Right. It's really not clear what's going to happen. Of course, you know, it's just going to take whether people from unions feel inspired by whoever the Democratic candidate is and whether they think that candidate is going to do things in their best interest. And as we heard from that man who voted for Trump, it's more complicated than just supporting unions for you know, a lot of these people. And so we'll just have to see if the vision that whoever the Democratic nominee is, the vision that they set out, if that resonates with union workers.
Okay, Katerina Sestarek, IPR's state government reporter. Thank you.
Thanks.
Well, on Wednesday of this week, the Trump administration unveiled that new rule that allows officials to detain migrant families indefinitely while judges consider whether to grant them asylum here in the United States. That's a rule that's certain to draw a legal challenge, but would abolish a previous 20-day limit. Of course, Donald Trump has made cracking down on legal and illegal immigration a hallmark of his presidency. After campaigning in 2016 on that promise, so far unfulfilled, that Mexico would pay for a border wall to keep migrants from entering the U.S. However, increased funding for immigration enforcement has been a big theme under this administration, and some Iowa businesses have experienced a boon from border enforcement and agency contracts. Let's talk with Zachary Oren Smith. He's been researching and writing about this. He writes about government growth and development for the Iowa City Press Citizen and the Des Moines Register. Welcome back to our program, Zachary.
Ben, thanks for having me.
Describe the rise in these contracts between Iowa companies and, two of these agencies, ICE, the Immigration and Customs Enforcement, and also Customs and Border Protection, CBP. Tell us what you found out.
To begin, I think it's important that we look at how these contracts look over time, right? So we used usaspending.gov data to look at fiscal years 2008 to 2018 to try to figure out how many contracts were being given to companies here in Iowa and how much those contracts were worth. And what our analysis revealed was that the fiscal year that Donald Trump came in under was a really singular year for contracting with Iowa companies.
Mm-hmm.
One of the things that we were really interested in was, you know, who was receiving that money, how much they were receiving, and, you know, I think fundamentally to what extent Iowa is connected to this conversation at the border. I think it is very easy for us to sit in with no borders shared with any other country to feel pretty removed from that conversation. So I think underscoring that, you know, the taking a contract with either agency is not an innately bad or good thing, right? These are contracts that are given out across the country. What we were interested in is letting our readers understand how we are connected to that issue.
Right. So tell us about the Iowa companies that garnered the largest share of contracts with these two agencies, ICE and CBP.
Yeah, well, so you'll be interested to know that these contracts ranged really widely. I mean, you had everything from office furniture, from H&I Corp, to you know, communications equipment from Rockwell Collins, located in Cedar Rapids. The large contracts we were looking at were between ICBP and Rockwell Collins, located in Cedar Rapids, and Career Management Assistance of Iowa, which Rockwell Collins had worth $54.5 million. And Career Management Assistance of Iowa, they had contracts worth in total worth $11.1 million. Mm-hmm. I mean, so really large contracts.
So you said you're tracking this over time, and since this administration has had the reins here on the immigration agencies here, there's been a dramatic increase for these five companies or others here in Iowa.
Those numbers were, of course, for the whole spectrum. So that's fiscal year 2008 to 2018. We could, of course, get more numbers for you, but I don't have those on me at this time.
Of course, we know the work of ICE authorities is under great scrutiny. It's very controversial at the moment. What reaction did you find to what you found, you looked up and reported on here?
Yeah, I mean, I think to begin, I was interested in first talking with some of these businesses. Unfortunately, we were not able to receive comment from any of the largest Iowa businesses that have these contracts.
They all declined.
They were all reached out to. They have not yet returned comment at the moment. But I am still very excited to have their comment. I very much would like to learn more from them. I think we did hear back from, as you mentioned, State Representative Bobby Kaufman, who I think for him, you know, he's very, very much in favor of sort of a more strict reformed approach to the border, with our southern border. And I think he would tell you that, you know, it's important that we think about how Iowa is contributing to this, right? That this is money. This is, you know, for Rockwell Collins, I mean, that's $54.5 million that's coming into this. You know, so for him, you know, I think he would think about it as, on one hand, he feels that there's an obligation for the state to monitor its border, or for the country to monitor its borders, to think about how, you know, to think about that border as a filter to what he called bad actors that might. But, you know, we also talked with the Iowa City Catholic Worker House, and they had a very different stance, saying that they looked to the Intercept's investigative report that found 8,400 reports describing the placement of immigration, custom, and enforcement detainees in solitary confinement. You know, they would look to reports like that and say, you know, maybe we need to reconsider our investment in agencies conducting some of these acts, right? That those are alleged reports, but nonetheless are ones that they would prefer the state not play a role in.
Mm-hmm. Okay, Zachary Oren Smith, researching and writing about rise in contracting between Iowa companies and the Immigration and Customs Enforcement Agency, also Customs and Border Protection. Zachary Oren Smith, thanks for coming into our studio.
Ben, thank you.
Well, the headline in USA Today reads, "Man asked about cruelty to a pig at the Iowa State Fair. He was ejected for life." Well, let's get the story behind that headline. It's a story that has, as you can see in USA Today, received a lot of national attention. Let's talk with the author of it. Lee Rood is with the Des Moines Register. She's the Reader's Watchdog columnist there. Hi, Lee.
Hi. Thanks for having me, Ben.
Well, thank you. And tell us this story here. It involves a man visiting the fair, a 40-year-old man named Wheaton Mather, is it? And start us off with what happened on August 9th, I believe.
Yeah, so he was there the first Friday of the fair, and at a certain point, he and a friend decided to go have a look at the livestock. He says that he turned a corner outside the pig barn and heard a big commotion, a lot of squealing from a pig. The animal seemed to be in distress, so he started taking video of the animal with his cell phone.
Mm-hmm. Lee, let me break in here because we, the Des Moines Register and USA Today, have that video that he took. But let's hear some of the audio of the obviously distressed pig, and then you can describe what we're seeing in the video. Lee, describe what we're seeing in the video, what you see.
So this is a boy that Wheaton estimated was about 11 or 12, and he was trying to coax a pig onto a trailer, but the pig was clearly in distress and was squeaking, and he's hitting the pig with a show stick, what's used typically in the ring in competition, in the face. And you can see injuries or lashes on the pig's face in the video.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so Mr. Mather, upon seeing this and taking this video, does what?
Well, he's not quite sure what to do that day. So he went and he approached somebody who looked to work to the fair, and that person said to contact the people who were working at the fair on horseback. He tried to do that. He asked if that kind of treatment to animals was typical, because he's a city dweller who moved to Iowa just 2 years ago. That person said that was typical, and he showed the video and used an expletive and said, "Is this typical?" He didn't get anywhere that day, but he returned to the fair on its last day after he had had some time to talk with friends and family. And he happened to run into the fair's CEO, Gary Slater. And there the two had a discussion about the video and what he'd seen. And then both sides kind of disagree about what happened next.
Mm-hmm. So the disagreement is over what in this exchange?
Sort of Mather's demeanor. The fair spokeswoman who was also there said that he was being combative, that really, you know, none of the answers they were giving him seemed to satisfy him, and that he was just more and more threatening and confrontational. Mather has since asked for any kind of camera at the fairgrounds or kind of body camera footage from police, because he says he wasn't being that confrontational. He was just very upset with Slater's reaction to his questions. He said he seemed to want to defer all of them to other groups like 4-H and FFA or to the boy's family.
Mm-hmm. And Mather had a friend there who actually backed up his description of what transpired with Slater. Isn't that right?
Yeah, that's true.
Mm-hmm. So when we talk about treatment of animals here, past his demeanor, that question, which the two sides don't agree on, what is the rule? What are the guidelines for the proper treatment of animals at the Iowa State Fair?
Well, I mean, kids get a lot of training in this before they go into competition, and you're not supposed to use a show stick or a hog whip, especially on the face of an animal. Any kind of cruelty like that is prohibited by fair rules. But, you know, as people have also pointed out, a lot of these kids are competing for the very first time. And so there are people that are supposed to be there on staff at the fair assisting them with sort of the right way to guide a pig. And in fact, I'm told that that's what happened in this incident, that livestock control came up as Mather was videotaping, or shortly thereafter, and told the family to put the sow back into its pen to calm down for 10 minutes. And then they helped the boy load the sow back onto the trailer without incident.
Mm-hmm. So having followed this, and you were contacted as the Reader's Watchdog columnist at one point, at what point?
Well, this was on the Sunday, I think, after Mather posted his video. He also reached out to me, as people often do, just kind of seeking answers or accountability. You know, his feeling, of course, is that FAIR officials overreacted to him by banning him for life. It was FAIR Police that did that. But also that they didn't do enough to take action to prevent this from happening again.
Mm-hmm. Lee, what questions, having followed this, done interviews about it, what questions are in your mind still about this story and, I guess, possible repercussions?
Well, I mean, you know, the FAIR has said that they have a protocol in place to prevent this from happening. My questions have to do with, have they ever taken any action against, you know, a youth at the FAIR for animal cruelty, and are they going to do so in this case? Because that's sort of the number one thing that people have asked me since the story published. But then there's the whole, you know, questions that we have about, you know, your constitutional rights at the FAIR. This man, you know, is accused of being confrontational and maybe even belligerent, but he was never charged with a crime. And so a lot of people are thinking that was overreached by banning he and his friends from the FAIR for life.
Mm-hmm. This was posted on Facebook by Wheaton Mather, but also your article has received a lot of attention. How much attention? How big is this in your world, in your journalistic world, in terms of a story?
Well, I had intended today to work on a completely different column, and I'm telling you, I'm not now. I think something like 50,000 people had read the article by the time I woke up this morning. So we'll be following it and making sure that we try to answer all the biggest questions for readers.
Right. Do you think this will have implications for the management of the Iowa State FAIR and its animals or new enforcement of existing rules?
I think, you know, some of the questions, you know, have to be there. People feel really strongly about animals in Iowa, right? So, you know, you have the whole animal welfare contingent, but also people who are concerned that people don't go overboard in their treatment of youth who are trying to learn about livestock at the FAIR. So I think one question people have is, should there be better signage at the FAIR to tell people like Wheaton Mather what to do when they see something that isn't right? And then also, yes, you know, is the FAIR going to take any action? Does it need to bolster its own policies? This thing is, you know, these kinds of things are being taken a lot more seriously at FAIRs across the country as people voice concerns about the humane treatment of livestock.
Lee, before I let you go, I have to ask you, because this triggered thoughts in my mind. You didn't write about this, but of course, here in Iowa, it triggers in my mind the question of the treatment of animals, not on show, not at the Iowa State FAIR, but livestock in our confinement facilities, the treatment of them, and the laws that we have here in Iowa as an ag state that, you know, make it very difficult to track how animals are treated because of ag gag laws. What are your thoughts there?
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, I haven't even scratched the surface of that. I'm just focused on how you're supposed to treat a sow. So, but yeah, you're right. That has been a big issue in the past. There's a balance here to be struck. People are reacting very, very strongly on both sides. And so I think it's just something that needs to be addressed. And, you know, the FAIR's protocols need to be made clear.
Okay, thank you very much. Lee Rood with the Des Moines Register, the Reader's Watchdog columnist there. Look for her column in the Des Moines Register or in USA Today. Thank you very much, Lee.
Thank you.
Right after a short break, Native American issues in the spotlight this week in a Sioux City forum. Also, we'll hear about Lost Island Theme Park in Waterloo breaking ground on a $100 million expansion. I'm Ben Kiefer. It's your News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. Back in just a moment.
Support for IPR and this podcast comes from the IMT Des Moines Marathon, October 19th and 20th, with 6 race events including the full and half marathons, marathon relay, 5K, and more. Register at DesMoinesMarathon.com.
And we're back with more of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News, a News Buzz edition where we have quick conversations to end the week. Coming up in a little bit, perhaps you've been to the Lost Island Water Park in Waterloo. Well, today the ground is being broken on the Lost Island Theme Park in Waterloo, a $100 million expansion. And we'll be talking with the general manager of Lost Island in just a few minutes. But first, earlier this week, the Sioux City Orpheum Theater was the site of a presidential forum focusing on Native American concerns. 9 Democratic presidential hopefuls attended, as well as hundreds in the audience. Let's talk with the moderator of that 2-day Frank LaMare Native American Presidential Forum. It was held Monday and Tuesday of this week. Let's talk with Mark Trahant, editor of Indian Country Today. Mark, joining us from Wisconsin, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
Tell us
in Nebraska, though.
You're in Nebraska. I saw on my screen something different, but no matter. Describe a little bit better, in more detail, what took place in Sioux City on the 2 days, Monday and Tuesday.
Well, we had really an extraordinary, like I mentioned, the 9 candidates. And this really started 12 years ago. There was a similar forum called Prez on the Res, and it was in Cabazon, California, and they invited all the presidential candidates. And only the minor candidates agreed to attend, Bill Richardson, Dennis Kucinich, and Mike Gravel. Barack Obama and Hillary Clinton both passed on it. What makes this one so extraordinary is that 9 candidates came, and it was all of the majors, really, except for former Vice President Biden. And the range of homework that the candidates did about Native issues, and were able to talk with tribal people about everything from treaty rights to funding of the Indian health system, all of that happened in a really comprehensive way. It was a pretty extraordinary day, 2 days.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's listen to several highlights from this forum, but one that called my attention was the emphasis on violence, the rates of violence for Native peoples, much higher than the rest of Americans. Let's listen to a bit of the forum. Here's Shannon Holsey representing the Stockbridge Munsee Band of Mohican Indians, citing government statistics about violence against Native American women in this country.
American Indian women are 10 times more likely to be murdered than the national average, and also 4 in 5 American Indian women will experience violence in their lifetimes. And homicide is the 3rd leading cause of death for American Indian girls between the ages of 10 and 24.
That was Shannon Holsey's preface for asking Senator Elizabeth Warren what she would do about that as president.
When I first got to Congress, the Violence Against Women Act was up for reauthorization. And I was one of the strong supporters of expanding VAWA to include indigenous women and specific provisions and specific resources for that. As you know, though, that bill has now been allowed to lapse. This is something we've got to be pushing back on and make sure that it has adequate and expanded protection over where we got it the last time. The other part, though, that I very much hear you talking about is the invisibility of the problem. That over and over, I'm struck by women who go missing and it doesn't make a headline for a week, for a month, women who are murdered, Native women, and it never makes a headline. A problem that is not seen is a problem that is not fixed.
Okay, this is really shocking to hear these statistics. Tell us, Mark, a little bit more about why violence is such a problem in the Native American community.
Sure. There are really a couple of reasons to start. First, there's the problem of how we collect data. There's really no form that says American Indians and Alaskan Natives in terms of violence and being able to get that through across the judicial system. So that would particularly be important on off-reservation communities in urban areas. The second one is jurisdiction areas. So if you're in what's legally called Indian country, but reservations mostly, the United States attorney has to prosecute a felony. And that means often that you have to meet a certain threshold before they'll send out FBI agents and the U.S. attorney will take up the case. Mm. And so many crimes just get unprosecuted because they don't reach that threshold. Tribes have long sought, and Senator Warren was one who said it directly, that they should have criminal jurisdiction over non-Indians for that very reason.
Mm-hmm. Talk about some more
more issues that were brought up in this forum that you feel and other members of indigenous members of our American community feel are underappreciated, underreported?
Sure. Probably the big one is treaty rights. So the United States promised so many things in the treaty era, and under the Constitution, treaties are the supreme law of the land. Yet, for example, many of the treaty provisions aren't fully funded or are not carried out as effectively as they could be. So tribes want to know what candidates are going to do to make more of that. So a great example is the Indian Health System. It's chronically underfunded. It serves American Indians and Alaska Natives who primarily live in Indian country. Only 1% goes to urban funding. Mm-hmm. Yet it's the lowest funded healthcare system in the country. In fact, there are more dollars spent on federal prisoners than those for the Indian health system
per capita. Yeah, who or what is to blame for that?
That's a tough one. I mean, really, it is Congress. Congress is the one that ultimately decides how dollars are spent, and it becomes kind of one where everyone in Congress will say, yeah, there are treaty rights, and yes, we should be doing it. But when it comes to actually appropriating the dollars, it just gets lost in the maze. Ironically, I think one of the fallouts from Medicare for All or any of the other universal health insurance proposals would be that the Indian Health Service would be able to build those systems and could actually produce full funding so that IHS would have on a per capita basis the same as Medicare or Medicaid or any other funding system.
We heard a moment ago a little excerpt from Senator Warren there. She began her remarks, and this is something that made the news across the country, with a brief apology regarding her past ancestry claims. But I wonder, she was obviously, when I looked at some of the tape of this forum, very well versed in Native American issues. What other candidates stood out as, I guess, being well versed, having done their homework, having impressed the Native American community on hand there at the Orpheum Theater?
Well, four candidates actually got standing ovations, so I guess I could use that as a metric. Mm. Senator Warren was one. Another one was Mark Charles, and he's a Navajo man who's running as an independent candidate for president. Mm. And he gave a long historical lesson about the doctrine of discovery and how, say, the Constitution is all male pronouns. So in a country where violence against women is an issue, he said it starts with the founding document. Bernie Sanders probably had the greatest applause and the greatest standing ovation. 4 years ago when he ran for office, he developed a really significant protocol for dealing with tribes. Whenever he was out across the country, he would make sure to meet with tribal leaders privately and have a conversation about that. Julian Castro was very popular as well. He started by acknowledging tribal land and talking about the tribes in Sioux City that whose lands those were on. And he also received a standing ovation.
Hmm. What impact do you hope to have by having this forum? And it's already had an impact, I guess, in the media. Do you see something further, greater happening there because of this renewed attention?
Sure. I think one of the big ones will be that no matter who wins the next election, this probably will be the pool of folks who will make decisions across a broad spectrum, whether or not in the administration if they win. But even if they don't, in the Congress of the United States, these will be many of the people who will be on key committees and such and be able to say, hey, I heard, I learned this at a conference, and here's something I can carry it forward. It may be that some of these people may end up being cabinet officials. So even if they're not president, they may be running a federal agency and suddenly say, wow, I have responsibility for this, and I'm going to try to step it up a bit.
Mark, when you sort of survey the last, four presidents, let's go back to maybe George W. Bush, including Obama, when you look at the modern presidency and then include this president's first 2.5 years, how do they measure in terms of treatment of the Native American community?
Well, in terms of the presidency, this is really interesting. So this will surprise a lot of people, but the two most profound presidents in the modern presidency have been Richard Nixon and Barack Obama. Hmm. And Richard Nixon took it very seriously. He had a coach at Whittier College that he just adored by the name of Wallace Newman. And when he went into the White House, he basically said, I'm going to make sure that that we do what we can to honor his memory and work to make that so. Second, Barack Obama, when he got in, decided to make sure that there was a tribal nations conference and that the United States worked with tribal people on a government-to-government basis. And throughout his 4 years, did that very judiciously. The current administration has basically delegated Native issues either to the Department of Interior or to energy companies. And that's really been the focus of this administration.
What is it, what are the implications of delegating that to energy companies?
Right. Coal, basically. The priority is energy development and including those on Indian lands.
Hmm. Any other concerns raised that were specific to the Midwest, to Iowa in the Midwest?
Well, one that came up from a young man was the issue of diversity in the media. And what's interesting, and basically representation across government. And the lowest representation anywhere is the federal judiciary. There are 3,600 Article III judges in the United States, and only one of them is Native American, and which is pretty extraordinary when you think about a country of this size. And Congress is actually now more representative than the news media.
Hmm.
Congress is about 0.66% Native American representation, and the news media is about 0.32%.
Hmm. I would wonder if your figures break that down into public media versus commercial media.
No, this is total media.
Okay. Maybe we'll have to do some digging there, Mark.
Right.
Okay. Mark Trahant is editor of Indian Country Today. Thanks for joining us to tell us about the Sioux City Forum, the presidential forum, 9 presidential candidates earlier this week, the La Mer Native American, Frank La Mer, Native American Presidential Forum, Monday and Tuesday in Sioux City. Mark Trahant was the moderator of that event. Thank you so much, Mark.
Happy to do it.
It's a News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Well, today crews are going to break ground on a new theme park in Waterloo. It's will be called the Lost Island Theme Park. It's a $100 million expansion to the Lost Island Water Park. Let's talk with Eric Birch, general manager of Lost Island. Eric, are you there?
Yes, Ben, I'm here.
Wonderful to have you. So what prompted this? It sounds like a huge expansion. What prompted it?
Well, the water park has been in the area now for 20 years, and about 10 years ago, we decided that if we wanted to increase the number of out-of-state visitors that we were bringing to the area, we were sort of reaching our cap with the type of visitor we were reaching with the water park, and a theme park draws from a much broader section of the public. So we did some research and found that was the direction we needed to move, but we also didn't want to go too quickly and put out a product that wouldn't meet our standards. So we have quietly been working on this for about a decade.
Mm-hmm. How will it be funded? Where's the money coming from?
The vast majority of it is a private funding. We're doing it ourselves with some help from city government and then some state assistance with the upgrade to the road that will act as the entrance through RISE funding.
Mm-hmm.
But the vast majority is a private investment.
I should mention that the Lost Island Water Park was recently named second best water park in the U.S. This was the annual Reader's Choice Survey in USA Today. Was that surprising to you? Congratulations, by the way.
Well, thank you. The USA Today poll, that's the third time that we've been ranked in their top 10. So we're pleased to be on there. Of course, the rankings on all these polls, Ben, are pretty, you have to take them with a grain of salt. It's nice to put your name next to them, but they can, I mean, we move up and down. Sometimes we're not on them at all. So We take the publicity when we can get it. But, I mean, we think that we're number one in the nation.
Of course. Just okay. So let me talk about the existing and then the future. So the Lost Island Water Park right now if I went to it, and I haven't made it to your water park yet, but if I was to be there, what is the one must go on ride?
So we have a water slide roller coaster hybrid that uses magnets to pull the ride vehicle uphill on four different occasions. And the reason that this is a must ride is because there are other versions of this ride that use water or high-speed conveyors to propel guests uphill. And the problem with those systems is that it's a constant velocity. So depending on the weight of the boat, you can have a jarring sensation syncing up with a conveyor, or the water pressure may have to build up before it can push it forward. The magnets intuitively understand how fast your boat is moving, and it's able to sync up immediately, so there's no loss of momentum. It's a smooth transition, so it's as if you are riding a roller coaster except in the water.
Okay, let's go to the future. The Lost Island theme park breaking ground today. What ride or couple of rides are must go on rides that you have planned?
We're trying to keep some of that information close to the vest since the park doesn't open for 3 years. However, some of the information that's already in the public domain involves two of the roller coasters we're going to be adding. We have a launch coaster that is 60 foot tall, and so you're going from 0 to 40 miles an hour in 2.3 seconds before going through the rest of this roller coaster. And then we also have a looping coaster that is a suspended ride vehicle, so your feet are hanging free, which is something that you would find at a Six Flags or Cedar Point, but not really anywhere within driving distance of Waterloo, Cedar Rapids, Des Moines.
Mm-hmm. I understand several homeowners in the nearby neighborhoods wrote some letters to the city with concerns about noise, light pollution, other potential impacts. How have you address those concerns?
Well, we feel that we have been pretty good neighbors with the water park and also the campground that we built. And we obviously understand their concerns and in no way want to tread on anybody's quiet backyards. The nearest home is over 1,800 feet away from the start of the park. And between that home and the park, there is a 50-foot natural hill that we will not be building on. So there's already a number of natural barriers. And then we're planning to have the park closed each night by no later than 10 o'clock. And all the lights are going to be focused downward into the park as opposed to older lighting systems that are broadcasting upward. So we are doing everything we can to mitigate those concerns, and we really feel that they should be minimal in the first place. And we, as I said, hope to be good neighbors to these residents because we want them to become our greatest advocates, as happened with the water park and the campground. I think
Eric, very quickly, we're running out of time in less than a minute. Two quick questions here. How many construction jobs for the local economy between now and the opening in 2022?
Somewhere around 200 to 300.
Mm-hmm. Long-term employment, once the park is open, how many will it employ?
We're looking at 25 full-time and then 250 to 300 seasonal workers.
Very good. The groundbreaking, I understand, is this afternoon?
That's correct.
And I'm sure you will be there.
Yes, I will.
Are you going to have the shovel in hand?
I will. We're actually preparing the site right now, getting things ready. So
okay, good luck with that.
I'll be here all day.
Good luck with that venture to you and your crew. Eric Birch is the general manager of Lost Island. The Lost Island theme park is breaking ground today. $100 million expansion to the Lost Island water park. Thanks, Eric.
My pleasure.
Let's finish up grooving into the weekend with IPR Studio One host Tony Daynor. Hi, Tony.
Hey, Ben.
Wow, that was exciting. We'll have to go to that water park. Maybe you and me together, huh, Tony?
Yeah, we'll take the kids. I live here, so yeah, you bet.
Okay. What do you got to groove us into the weekend today?
Okay, Sturgill Simpson, very excited about this one. He is nominally a country singer, but he gets a little less country with every album, as you're about to hear. This new record just announced is called Sound and Fury. It comes out in September, and there's going to be an accompanying anime film. We've got the first single now. It's called Sing Along. This is Sturgill Simpson.
Okay, we'll rock out of this program with Sturgill Simpson. Let's keep him going here. Tony Daner, thanks, and be sure to tune in on the weekend or any day of the week to IPR's Studio One. Thanks, Tony.
Thanks, Ben.
River to River is produced by Shirley Wong, Rick Brewer, and Caitlin Harrop. Also help today from Julia DiGiacomo. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us. You done me wrong.